You guys, for this lecture, we'll be discussing fetal membranes. So it's another round of embryology, kind of an abstract area in medicine, but it can be fun too. So you guys need to piggyback on what you learned in term one, and then maybe a bit of the DLEs, and then we kind of, so I'm going to make it like a story because it's early development. Most of the things we are talking about, we talk about them happening week one, week two, and then we talk about the membranes themselves. So we have some objectives to cover, and we just go from there. When we talk about fetal membranes, basically, we talk about the amnion, the chorion, what we call the umbilical vesicle, and also your allantoid. But the thing is, because we're going to piggyback, you have to talk about, like, okay, how does the development itself start? We talk about a man meeting a woman, the sperm meeting the ovum, and then you talk about fertilization occurring in the ampulla of the fallopian tube. Once that happens, the first product you get, the zygote, starts to undergo some divisions, which I know that you guys know already. So it goes from a two-cell stage, it begins to multiply, 2, 4, 8, 16, can go to 32. At the 16-cell stage, we call it a morula. And then the cells you have there, they begin to call them the blastomeres, right? So within around 16, 32-cell stage, and as that happens too, the product starts to move down from the fallopian tube towards the uterus where implantation occurs. Because you now have the blastomeres, a cavity also happens inside of it where you have fluid, clear fluid, and it becomes the blastocyst. That's still around day 5, day 6. Once you have your blastocyst, some divisions, some changes also start to happen. It's like things happening. 5, 6, and your blastocyst itself now, we can now talk about the formation of the bilaminar germ disc, where it can be divided into what we call the inner cell mass and the outer cell mass, which is where all these membranes we talk about begin to take shape or begin to form. So if you understand everything we're talking from the beginning to the stage of the blastocyst, then we can move on. Once you have the blastocyst, then it differentiates itself into what we call the inner cell mass and the outer cell mass. Your outer cell mass is what we call the trophoblast, which then differentiates again into two layers, the syncytiotrophoblast and the cytotrophoblast. The cytotrophoblast is on the inside, the syncytiotrophoblast is on the outside. And then your inner cell mass is what we call the embryoblast, or what gives you the definitive embryo. So this is just like the first slide showing us the different types of membrane. And then we go from there into like the development of the bilaminar germ disc and how we talk about the formation of the different membranes. So the first one we're going to talk about, like I said, once you have your inner cell mass, your outer cell mass, it's just more development occurring, more development, more changes. These cells, they divide, these cells will give rise to, they migrate, and then eventually you form the membranes we're talking about today. So the first thing is, like I said, your embryoblast is what will give you the definitive embryo. And it divides into a bilaminar, it divides into two again. So it's a division thing. Your embryoblast, which is like your inner cell mass, will even undergo more division. So it divides into a layer of cells, inside and outside, or closer to or farther away from. So the first ones you have your hypoblast. The hypoblasts are farther away. They're on the side of the blastocyst cavity. This is initially what you had. We said we have a blastocyst. The blastocyst divided into embryoblast and or what we call the inner cell mass, and then it also divides into the outer cell mass or the trophoblast. In this picture, the trophoblast is not even here at all. Then the embryoblast itself divides again, differentiates into two layers again. One which we call the hypoblast. The hypoblasts are a group of cells that face the blastocyst cavity. This is your blastocyst cavity. So the cells around this area facing the blastocyst cavity, we call them the hypoblast. And then a group of cells too will be on the other side, opposite the hypoblast, which we call the what? Or the rest of them, we call them the epiblast. And then your trophoblast will be this layer of cells. So, and there are two of them. You have the cytotrophoblast, which is on the inside, and then you have your syncytio just forming on the outside. Your cytotrophoblast is a layer of mononucleated cells, but they are very, very active in terms of division. They are mitotically active. And they are actually the ones that give rise to the cells of the cytotrophoblast and also more cells of the syncytial trophoblast. The syncytial trophoblast on its own is very, very invasive, or we say erosive. So it's going to burrow into the layer of the endometrium, which is your uterus. So it's all these processes happening that will form what we call the fetal membranes eventually. So we take it from the hypoblast, epiblast. We go from the hypoblast and epiblast. So you can see again the labels, everything is showing. Epiblast on the inside, hypoblast outside, lining the blastocyst cavity. And then you have your trophoblast, which is made up of your cytotrophoblast on the inside and your syncytial on the outside. I know you must have done this maybe in term one or maybe from your DLA. Your syncytial trophoblast is actually very important because it is the one that produces that substance called the human chorionic gonadotropin, which forms the basis of the pregnancy test. And the human chorionic gonadotropin that is secreted is what helps in the early stages of pregnancy, that it sends signals to the corpus luteum, which I think you will have done. If you've not done it, you're going to do female reproductive in embryology and some physiology to be able to understand it better. So it sends signals to the corpus luteum, and the corpus luteum helps you to produce your progesterone, which is what keeps the pregnancy until the placenta becomes functional and can take over that function. So some of these things are very, very important. But like I said, keep some of these things in mind. Syncytial trophoblast, very, very erosive or invasive. It's going to burrow into the endometrium. Your cytotrophoblast is just a layer of mitotically active cells. And then you have on your inside your embryoblast differentiating into your hypoblast and epiblast. And then we take it from there. The story continues. Inside of your now that we have the epiblast, which is the one on the outside, a small space now appears around the embryoblast. That's what will form your amniotic cavity eventually. You know, we're talking about the amnion. So that's how one of the membranes form. A small space occurs. More division, more growth of the embryo itself. A small space appears, and then you have fluid inside of it. There, you form your amniotic cavity. It's still the same group of cells, but they kind of rearrange. On this side, towards this side, so don't forget that, and that's why they use colors. Embryology is like you're imagining, because it's something that happens in utero. You know, they had to study maybe these different stages of the fetus. That's how we came to know all these things. So this is your, like on this side, you have your cytotrophoblast. This is your syncytial on the outside growing now. Those two trophoblasts. On this side, embryoblast. But embryoblast is, differentiation is still going on. You know that embryoblast has differentiated to your hypoblast on this side, and then these blue ones are your epiblast. But then a space now shows, as the embryo grows, a space now shows inside, which we call the primordial amniotic cavity, which will form your definitive amniotic cavity eventually. As this space shows, a group of these cells will now line this inside of the amniotic cavity on the opposite side. Those cells are called the amnioblasts or the amniogenic cells. You guys get it? They are called the amnioblasts. And then on the opposite side, you still have your epiblast. So they are like they form the floor of your amniotic cavity, and it's a continuous thing. That's how your amniotic cavity forms. That's like the first thing, right? So same thing, syncytial burrowing, growing, cytotrophoblast is just there. It's usually said that the trophoblast is much more, like in these early stages, the trophoblast grows faster, at a very, very rapid rate compared to the embryoblast. But now, we don't really see embryoblast again because the process is changing. Now you have your amniotic cavity forming, you have your amniotic or amniogenic cells or your amnion on this side, and then you have your hypoblast. This is still your blastocyst cavity. You know, we started from the blastocyst cavity, like the blastocyst. The blastocyst was like the divisions of the cell, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, and then a fluid space happened here, and then you had your blastocyst. It's from there that we differentiated into embryoblast and your trophoblast. So this is still your blastocyst cavity, which will be also be filled with fluid. But the thing is, because there's further growth, these layers of cell, which I call the hypoblast, the yellow ones on the outside here, they also form a membrane, which you call the Ewers membrane or your exosylomic membrane. So the thing is that the hypoblast will now, they divide, and then you have the cells lining the inside of like your cytotrophoblast. Don't forget that your cytotrophoblast is still here. But you can see a different layer of cells on the inside of the blastocyst cavity. That's what forms the Ewers membrane, or what we call the exosylomic membrane. This is your uterus, the endometrium. It has blood and everything, which we will still talk about later. So we form the amnion, right? We form the amnion. Sorry. Now we'll talk about the, I mentioned the blastocyst cavity. It's not going to be blastocyst cavity forever. It's going to form something else. That's what forms like your primary yolk sac, the yolk sac, which we all talk about. In development, you also need to talk about it. So this changes. There's more development as these cells, as the uterus membrane forms, the hypoblasts differentiate and line the inside of the blastocyst cavity. The name changes too. It's no longer called the blastocyst cavity. We now call it the what? The primary yolk sac. And the yolk sac is important because what are the important things? That's the first site where blood formation occurs, the blood cells. So if you've done it, I know you've done it in term one, when you talked about blood. We talk about the yolk sac, then the different other organs, spleen, liver, bone marrow, at different stages. So it starts from, as early as the second, third week, blood formation starts too, because you need blood formation for a lot of things to also happen, organogenesis. So that's the first site of blood formation. It's an important thing you need to know. And then your yolk sac also gives rise to your primordial gut, that is like the GIT eventually. And another thing is, which is very important, you guys are doing endocrine and reproductive now, system. So the thing is, the primordial germ cells, both male and female, they actually arise from the endoderma, or the inside lining of the yolk sac. It is from the inside lining of the yolk sac that your primordial germ cells will originate, and then they migrate to the definitive gonads. So when we talk about the primordial germ cells, like they now migrate to the sites, like so your spermatogonia, your oogonia, before they become the oocyte or the sperm, eventually the mature one, which I know you will still do some of those stages, the division, they actually arise as primordial germ cells from the wall of your yolk sac. So basically now, more development, more features happening. Still amniotic cavity, you have your fluid there, clear fluid, we don't have a name for it yet. The cells lining it on the inside are your amnioblast or amnion, your amniogenic cells. These are your epiblast. On the outside of that, you have your hypoblast. The hypoblast differentiates and gives you what we call the exocoelomic membrane or your uterus membrane. This used to be the blastocyst cavity, but now it's called what? The yolk sac. And then you need to talk about the importance of the yolk sac. As those things are going on the inside, these guys, your syncytial and your cyto are also what? The syncytial keeps burrowing. It keeps enlarging, going more and more. Because this is around the time where you want to implant into the uterus too. It keeps burrowing into the endometrium of the uterus. And as so some of these things, some of these processes happening is what eventually form your placenta, which we will talk about. But I'm going to keep it, we'll talk about the placenta later. So we'll talk about amnion, we'll talk about the yolk sac. The next thing we'll talk about is the allantoid. That one is just like from the yolk sac itself, you have like an outpouching, what we call a diverticulum. It just extends into the body stalk, like the main body. You know, the thing is, I talked about outer cell mass, the trophoblast, and then there's an inner cell mass, which you call the embryoblast. Your embryoblast is what forms your definitive embryo. So it's not like once the inner cell mass differentiates and is growing, that's when you start seeing that curvature, the shape of the baby begins. Initially, it was all cell mass, round figures around this region. But by the time it grows, you start having this. So somewhere around there is where the yolk sac is, and then the diverticulum extends or pops up. And that's around the third week, which is what forms the allantoid. It's also another early site of blood formation. But a very, very important part of it is that eventually we talk about the umbilical vessels. So the blood, the arteries or the vessels that supply your allantoid in that early stage of development are the ones that will eventually give rise to your umbilical vessels, which you talk about the arteries and the veins. We will look at the umbilical cord and we'll talk about the vessels that run in it. So that's how the umbilical vessels form, the arteries and the vein. And then eventually, when the baby is born, because you will not need the umbilical vessels for life, that space from the yolk sac where the diverticulum pops out or emerges eventually becomes obliterated. And in the adult is what forms the uracus, which we also, eventually, when you see it, postnatally, is now forms the median umbilical ligament. I know you might have mentioned it, but it's something that is very, very important. They can ask you the remnants of the uracus, or the median umbilical ligament was initially what? So obliterate, forms the uracus, and your uracus in adult or postnatally is what forms the median umbilical ligament. So there are different types of umbilical ligaments. You need to know what was their precursor. These are things that they can test to. They are very, very high yield to, even up to the level of the steps. So median umbilical ligament comes from your uracus, which is like from the allantoid. When it's obliterated, you form the uracus, and postnatally, that's what you have. So that's another membrane that we dealt with. It's very simple. Just from the yolk sac, you have a diverticulum, imagine, and that one goes into the body stalk. Why do you want to have the allantoid? You want to pass, you want to form umbilical vessels that will travel in the umbilical cord to be able to do what? Exchange of material from the mother to the fetus. And the vessels that supply the allantoids are the ones that form the umbilical vessels. And then eventually it's obliterated. That's no function again as an adult. Just that you need to know that it forms the median umbilical ligament. Don't confuse it with the medial umbilical ligament, because that one comes from something else. This is another section. Same thing we're talking about, but now it's a different cut from this one that you're looking at, because this one is just showing you the uterus and the embryoblast with the outer cell mass as they're burrowing. This one now, they are showing you a different cut. So we already around the second week. Amnion on the inside, the yolk sac. Then you have the embryonic disc, which is like the one that gives rise to the embryo proper. So the fluid inside of the amniotic cavity, which is clear fluid, we now call it what? The amniotic fluid. You get it? And then the amniotic fluid comes from a lot of sources, which is something you need to know. The maternal blood itself, as the syncytiotrophoblast, which is that layer that makes contact initially with the mother through the endometrium of the uterus, as it continues to burrow, the fetus also comes in contact with the maternal blood. And that some of those ones will actually get into the amniotic cavity, maybe by process of diffusion. Some of the cells will not be there, so it's going to be clear fluid. It's not just but the maternal blood is part of it, but it's not like you have the blood cells there too, so it's clear. And then the fetal urine. The fetus will also make urine. Some of it are also as part of the things that form the amniotic fluid. The skin too, like extravasation of fluid from the skin, and then secretions from the respiratory tract. All those things that, some of those things that compose what we now call they make it up, the source, the amniotic fluid. And it's mainly water. But then you still have some other things like protein, glucose, vitamins, antibodies, and antigens. So they have some immune function too. But majorly water, just like most things too. So it's mostly in a liquid composition, but you have some protein, glucose, vitamin, antibodies, and antigen inside of it. Another thing you need to know is that it circulates. You get the sources, the amniotic fluid from different sources, comes to the fetus in that amniotic cavity, but then it's not constant. The circulation changes every 3 hours. And then how does the fetus take care of it? The fetus actually takes care of it by what? Swallowing. As part of this lecture, we'll still look at some disorders of amniotic fluid volume. It can be too high or it can be too low. So the fetus swallows it. And when we talk about the disorders, you will see why. And what happens if a fetus cannot swallow? Maybe if it is due to a problem with the gastrointestinal tract, or if it is due to a problem with the brain, where some fetus don't have the part of the brain to swallow. So all those disorders can lead to whether it's high or it can be low. Okay? I think we can take a pause here by doing our first clicker question. So let's see what you guys have gathered so far. Okay, majority of us got it right. So I think it's pretty straightforward. Still a question from the story we've been discussing. Amniotic cavity forms during implantation of the blastocyst, early development, right? So the question is just asking, within which of the following structures does it form, right? And if we go back to what we were discussing, we were talking about blastocysts differentiate into embryoblast, trophoblast, embryoblast now differentiates into epiblast and what? Hypoblast. So, I mean, even if I don't really understand the lecture, because I know you may still need to go back home to like digest some of these things we're talking about. I know that the cytotrophoblast and the syncytial trophoblast, like they're on the outside, so they won't really form the amniotic cavity. So I'm going to eliminate that. And the maternal endometrium is even further away from that, because that's where your syncytial trophoblast is going to burrow into. So the last three, I just eliminate them. And then if you've followed my story so far, hypoblast, epiblast, which one is on the inside? Which one is on the inside? Which one is on the inside? Close to the amniotic cavity, epiblast. And the hypoblast is on the outside. The hypoblast is what forms your Ewers membrane. The epiblast is the group of cells closer. Inside of the epiblast is where the amniotic cavity pops up. And you have your fluid. So the epiblast is the answer. And a lot of you guys got it. So for those that picked the wrong ones, just try to understand this. Let me see if I can get a picture. Yeah. So I think this slide can talk about it. This area is what you are looking at. Cytotrophoblast is somewhere here. Syncytial is this one. Right? Yeah. And this is your hypoblast. This one is hypoblast. This is your epiblast. Inside of this is where your amniotic cavity pops up. And that's what they are asking you. Once this guy pops up, you have a layer of cells on the inside of that, on the opposite side, this one, which we call the amnion or the amniogenic cells. And these guys will still remain your epiblast. So that's what the question is all about. It's pretty straightforward. And they can test you on that too. So where were we? Let's go. Yeah, so the answer is epiblast. Now we talk about the amniotic fluid functions. Why do we have the amniotic fluid? And it's like in the embryoblast, where the definitive embryo forms. You want to have that because you want to have something that will do like a shock absorber. There's movement. The fetus itself will move. So you need the amniotic fluid for easy movement too, to be able to turn. As the baby grows, the fluid also becomes, the volume increases. So initially, if you guys have had experience with people that are pregnant or you've seen an ultrasound, if you follow a pregnant woman during the different stages of pregnancy, initially you just see the gestational sac, like the sac itself. And then as it begins to see, you start seeing the body features, the head, the limbs, because they form too. Around fourth, fifth week, the limb buds, so you start seeing all those things. And then later on, you see it, sometimes the head of the fetus will be up here. And then at some point in time, it can turn, and then it goes down there. So for movement, that's one of the purpose of the amniotic fluid. It allows for very easy movement, less friction. And then there's also a shock-absorbing property to it. You know, as there's movement, there's this shock-absorbing property that it gives. Even the mother also moves, not to talk of the baby itself. And then constant temperature, like it has an homeostatic function too. You want to maintain a constant body temperature, fluid and electrolyte balance. Those are some of the things the amniotic fluid does. And then it contributes to the development of the lungs. Like I said, some of the sources of the amniotic fluid is secretion from the respiratory tract. As you have that too, depending on the volume, the lungs also develop. We won't go into like what exactly does it do, but just know that it also helps in the development of the lung. Such that if you have an abnormality with the production of the amniotic fluid, you can have what we call pulmonary hypoplasia, where the lung fails to develop. And then it can be a syndrome or a sequence. You will learn that later, maybe in pathology or sometime in this module. And then, like we said, the antibodies, the antigens, they play an immunologic role. So they have an antibacterial activity, and it starts like a wedge. The wedge is still more like what I was talking about in terms of the shock-absorbing property. As the baby grows, the volume increases because you may need more. It's not no longer small. And then another thing that happens is that it fuses with what we call the chorion. your chorion, I will describe how we form the chorion. That's another membrane. The way I want you guys to look at it is the amnion is on the inside. The chorion is on the outside in terms of the relation to the embryo. Closer, inside is the amnion on the opposite side. So you see what I was saying? You see this now, growing more and more. Can you see it? As opposed to the round figure we had before. The head is forming the limb buds, and then you have this guy. So eventually it fuses with the chorion, and then you have a single amniochorionic membrane. The amniochorionic membrane is like the bag that ruptures when a woman, for most women, is very close to labor. They say she passed water. Or in some women, they don't even rupture it. We actually perform an amniotomy. The doctor goes in and uses a hook to break it, and then the fluid comes out. But that is what holds the fluid, and the fluid inside is the amniotic fluid. So it forms from both membranes, like it becomes a single membrane, an amniochorionic membrane. And that's so it's like a wall, if it's very sterile inside, infection cannot get in there, you know? So it's like it protects the baby itself, and the fetus floats inside of it with the cord attached to the placenta. So the umbilical cord, we'll talk about it later. As these things go on, the placenta also begins to form. The placenta forms from the trophoblast. I just want you guys to see it that way. So the trophoblast, when I was talking about the syncytial trophoblast, the cytotrophoblast, those ones will contribute to the placental component. A very, very important thing we need to talk about is the disorders of amniotic fluid volume. It can be too much. It can be too small. You don't want it to be too much. You don't want it to be too small. So in obstetrics, normally, they do something we call measurement of the amniotic fluid index. They go in and do, like, there are four vertical pools, and they take the depth, and then they measure it. If it is between, so if it is very low, there's a value, which you learn later as you progress in your medical career. When it's less than that, we say it's oligo. Oligo means reduce. Oliguria, reduce urine. Oligohydraminous, low amniotic fluid volume. If it is very high, poly, more, right? So low volume, we say when it's less than what? 400 to 500. In the third trimester. Or maybe there's just an inadequate amount. The fetal urine is not much. The secretions are not much. So you have less, right? So why do we have less? Maybe a woman has premature rupture of membrane. That membrane I discussed that keeps the baby inside that is sterile, where the amniotic fluid floats. Sometimes it may rupture before time, maybe due to trauma or maybe infection. So if it ruptures, the woman starts to leak the fluid. Once that happens, the next thing is to deliver the baby. So it may not be up to term. Like term is 37 weeks, at least 37 completed weeks of gestation. Some people have rupture of membranes before that time. And then you can lose the fluid. So the fluid can be very reduced. Or if the person has, if the baby has a urinary system anomaly, because we say that the amniotic fluid also comes from some of the sources from what? The fetal urine. And for you to make urine, the renal system, the kidneys must be developed. Your kidneys, ureter, and all those things. So if some people have what we call bilateral renal agenesis, meaning that the kidneys fail to form, the agenesis does not develop. Once you see a child with bilateral renal agenesis, most likely that child will also have lung hypoplasia because the amniotic fluid is needed for the lung to develop. And if you have a baby like that, the usual story they give you is the baby was born and then within 1 hour or 2 hours died because they are not, it's not compatible with life. They won't survive. So that's another thing that can cause what? A reduction in the amniotic fluid volume. And then it can also be due to placenta insufficiency. Some people have placentas, but then the placenta may not function properly. Maybe due to, maybe a woman was pregnant and she was smoking, this cigarette, the nicotine in cigarette is vasotoxic. So it will affect the vessels in the placenta and it will affect the blood flow through the placenta, the exchange of nutrients. As a result of that, because you know the maternal blood contributes to your amniotic fluid, as a result of that, the volume can be reduced. Or so cigarette smoking can contribute, or it may just be trauma, or maybe some diseases like diabetes or hypertension. So those things that can affect the vasculature can eventually lead to a reduction in the amniotic fluid volume. The complications, I kind of mentioned one of it already, lung hypoplasia. If you don't have adequate volume, then the lungs will not develop properly. If the lungs do not develop properly, the baby will not survive. They will not be able to take that spontaneous breath that they take. And then the other thing is the limb anomaly. You need the fluid too, the movement. So it can be, they can have limb anomalies as a result of that. The other disorder is high, it's too much. So the value given is 2,000 liters in the third trimester. It's very, very much. Why do we have much? Like most things in medicine, we say it's idiopathic. We don't know. They just don't know. It contributes about 60%. And then in the other causes, it can be due to the mother. If you have multiple pregnancy, in multiple pregnancy is the state of where you have more, excessive HCG production, excessive amniotic fluid volume because you have two fetuses. And then maybe the mother has diabetes too, can also contribute. So you see diabetes on both sides. And then fetal, can also be fetal too. Maybe they have oesophageal atresia. So I was talking about, we talk about swallowing. If the child has disorders that will not allow swallowing of the fluid to take it away, then you have more. So during the development of the oesophagus, so it may fail to develop at all, or there may be a fistula. And some babies may also have anomalies in the brain where the swallowing center will not just work, and then they will not be able to swallow it. It's seen in about 1% of pregnancies in the U.S. So the complications, again, preterm labor before term. You deliver the baby before term, and then it can also cause premature rupture of membrane. The other problem with the amniotic fluid that we talk that you need to know is the amniotic band syndrome. So this one is that the amniotic fluid is supposed to be sterile. There's nothing supposed to go into it. But sometimes it can be that barrier can be breached. You get it? That barrier can be breached. And then you have like proteins going into it, causing problems that can eventually cause the amniotic fluid to constrict some of the parts of the baby. That can eventually, because it's a long process. Sometimes you just see they may be tying, but sometimes it can actually lead to amputation of the limbs. I've actually seen a baby before that had that, actually, amniotic band syndrome, classical. Like this picture you are seeing here, this one. So it can lead to amputation. That's just the amniotic fluid itself. Once it's breached, it's not a normal thing, it's a problem. Once that barrier, the amniotic membrane is breached, and then you have proteins, like it coagulates, then you don't have the fluid again. But you know, it's the fluid that surrounds the baby. So as a result of that, you can have constriction. So we call it the amniotic band syndrome. And it can amputate the limbs. Okay, we'll go again. Chorion. Now, this is the other guy, which is important. So like I told you guys, look at it like this is on the outside, the periphery. Amnion is on the inside, right? But it's still the same process going on. Syncytial trophoblast is burrowing into the endometrium. You have your amniogenic cells here. You have the amniotic cavity. And this is your epiblast or your embryonic disc. Outside of here, you have your hypoblast. The hypoblast will proliferate to form your exocoelomic membrane. Right? And then you have your primary yolk sac. As the syncytial trophoblast continues to burrow, very erosive, very invasive guy, into the endometrium, because that's what's happening, you are implanting. As it continues to do that into the uterus has vessels. There are different types of vessels in the endometrial layer of the uterus. We talk about the spiral arteries and the straight arteries. So the spiral arteries too will come in contact with your syncytial trophoblast, and then you start having spaces, lacunae, inside of it. So that one is going on the outside. You get it, the maternal blood. That's the early stages of the process of formation of your placenta. You get it? And then the other thing is the inside here, this is your amnion with your amniotic cavity, and then this is like your primary yolk sac. Between them, you have what we call the primary mesoderm. It's just a core of connective tissue. It just comes to fill the space between them. So you see what we say? You see, a core of connective tissue fills the trophoblastic wall between the outer trophoblast and the amniotic cavity and the primary yolk sac. That one forms, and then that we start talking about extra embryonic coelom, extra outside of the embryo, because your embryonic disc is what forms your definitive embryo. But then you are going to separate this from it. I think I have pictures that show it eventually. So that's the next thing you want to form. It's the process of formation of those things, the mesoderm coming in, that eventually leads to formation of the chorion. And that's why I said, just look at it like the chorion is on the outside, the amnion is on this side. Let's see. So in that, in this space, the blue is the embryonic disc, definitive embryo, the one that will form the body eventually. Your amniotic cavity is somewhere here. That's where the fluid will fill into. And then you have your primary yolk sac. In between this and this, mesoderm, core connective tissue. Mesoderm is connective tissue. There are three germ layers, endoderm, ectoderm, and mesoderm. I know you've done it before. The mesoderm is what gives rise to all connective tissue, but there are different types. It fills into that space, which is still an embryonic tissue. And then you have what we call the extra embryonic coelom. But how does it happen? Once it fills into that space, then you have clefts, like spaces inside of it, right? Spaces begin to form, and then eventually those clefts, like they are breaks, they fuse eventually to form your chorionic cavity, or what we call the extraembryonic sedum. But it doesn't stop there, right? Because if you remember, I talked about, don't forget that you still have your cytotrophoblast. The cytotrophoblast is dividing. It is contributes cells to your syncytiotrophoblast on the outside. But the thing is that inside of here, once you have your extraembryonic sedum form, you also have more connective tissue, and then they now differentiate because you want to separate this from this. So the name changes too, in a way. And I'm going to see, yeah. I think it's this one, yeah. So the name changes. Here, you see this process? This is like the embryonic disc, amniotic cavity, the amnion, and the epiblast. But then this forms. This was, everything here before we said was what? Your yolk sac. But then when that connective tissue, that core of connective tissue comes in, we talk about what? Extraembryonic cilium. And then we go from extraembryonic cilium, we now differentiate it again. The connective tissue will now become two. Like the line, some closer to the body wall, some closer to the baby itself, or eventually to the organs. So we talk about extraembryonic splanchnic mesoderm, and then we talk about extraembryonic somatic mesoderm. Soma, body wall, the outside. So if you look at this, this one, between the cytotrophoblast and the inside, this one is where you have your extraembryonic somatic mesoderm. And then the one that is very close to this thing that is forming on inside is what forms your extraembryonic splanchnic mesoderm. How do you make sense of it? Splanchnic is usually related to the viscera inside. So the one closer is still the connective tissue that once it comes in, shows the cleft appears and then they fuse. That's when you form your cilium. But then you want to differentiate the one closer to the baby and the one closer to the outside that will form the body wall. So the one closer to the outside, we call it the extraembryonic somatic mesoderm. And the one that is closest inside, you form your what? Extraembryonic splanchnic mesoderm. And then inside of it is where you have your extraembryonic cilium. And that's what forms the chorion. The chorion is like outside to the amnion. That is another fetal membrane. So a thing they can ask you, a question they can ask you is what makes up the chorion itself? Because as this is the somatic mesoderm is related to the outside, it's also touching the syncytio and the cytotrophoblast. So they also contribute to part of it. You get it? So it's made up of what? The syncytiotrophoblast, the cytotrophoblast, and the somatic layer, your extraembryonic somatic mesoderm. So that's what forms the chorion. And then eventually, it's all these things that will form the placenta proper. So for the chorion itself, there's something, I'm going to try to say a story, and I hope you guys still related to what we are talking about. As the syncytiotrophoblast continues to burrow into the endometrium, don't forget that that is what it is doing. The cytotrophoblast will keep on dividing to give cells into it. So it continues to make contact with it. The syncytiotrophoblast is not dividing. The cytotrophoblast is the one that is mitotically active and keeps dividing. As it is doing that, when they touch, you form what we call the chorionic villus. But the thing with the chorionic villus is that it also undergoes different stages. So you have what we call the primary chorionic villus. Your primary chorionic villus is that interaction between your cytotrophoblast and your syncytiotrophoblast, right? So this also forms around this time your chorion is forming. They are touching, and then you have your chorionic villi primary. Then if there's a primary, then there's a secondary, and there's a tertiary. What happens? How do you form a secondary? The secondary forms when the mesoderm that you talk about, which is your embryonic connective tissue, when it also enters into that interaction between the cytotrophoblast and the syncytiotrophoblast. And when that happens, we call our chorionic villi a secondary chorionic villi. Right? And then from the secondary, the tertiary forms. The tertiary forms when the vessels, you know, the syncytio is on the outside. The spiral arteries from the maternal uterus is in contact with the syncytiotrophoblast. Lacunae forms, spaces. And then you have that exchange, pinocytosis, diffusion. That's how the embryo that is still small at that stage is getting nutrients, right? But by the time your secondary chorionic villi forms and capillaries begins to form inside of it, then you form what we call a tertiary chorionic villi. There's a reason why I'm talking about this, because there's a disorder you need to know as physicians, which we'll talk about later. So we have the chorion wall, chorionic villi. Some of the chorionic villi, so it has different parts too. You get it? Some of it can be smooth chorion. So like decidua is related to the maternal uterus. You get it now? So we have different parts. We talk about the... Yeah, have I skipped anything? Okay, no. So like that interaction between the cytotrophoblast and the syncytiotrophoblast, you have like projections, finger-like projections, which you call the coronae villi. And then the sac enlarges towards the uterine cavity, still on the outside, as the syncytiotrophoblast is doing its own thing, going on and on. But the thing I want to point out is that the decidua, the chorionic wall, there are different types. You have the decidua basalis. The basalis is very close to the maternal uterus, basal, right? That one, and that one has the projections on it. Then you have the capsularis, the one that covers it, and then the one that is not even related at all on the outside, not related to anything, is what we call the parietalis. So you need to know the different types, right? I think I'll still talk about it one more time. But the story I talked about in terms of the coronic villi, the primary, the secondary, and the tertiary, why do we talk about it? The reason is that sometimes the baby, the embryo itself, the embryoblast, may not develop. Some people have, like we talk about spontaneous abortion. There are different types. It can be induced, but some spontaneous, the baby just stops growing for whatever reason. Maybe it could be congenital anomalies, or maybe hormone problems. Progesterone is no longer being produced in sufficient amount, and the embryo dies. When the embryo dies, because your coronae villi is also supposed to complete their development, primary to tertiary. But when the embryo dies, cystic spaces now begin to happen in the tertiary villi because they do not form. They are not vascularized. They form cystic swelling, which we call iditiform moles. This is very important because sometimes the woman will have that history that, okay, last menstrual period was so time, and then now she's no longer menstruating as an iditiform mole. We talk about a molar pregnancy. You need to monitor because in some percentage of cases, this mole can become, they have a malignant potential. And we talk about malignant trophoblastic lesions, which you call the choriocarcinoma. This is what you see on ultrasound when in a woman that has that. So you have to monitor. We call it molar pregnancy. It's a mole. The embryo does not develop, but that chorionic villi forms cystic swelling. So we say it's a molar pregnancy. And in such pregnancy, they produce a lot of HCG. So you need to monitor. You need to monitor, right? Until then, you can treat it maybe by curettage or you give drugs until it falls down and then you may remove it and then you can get pregnant after a while. So this decidua, I was trying to explain, I think, yeah, this one, the previous picture is still here again. So you have the basalis deep to the chorion in contact with the villous chorion, but it's like the one closest to the uterus itself. And then the one related to the smooth chorion where there's no projection is your capsularis, right? This one is smooth. This one is villi. There's villi on top of it, and it's close to the uterus, the base. And then the parietalis is the rest, not related at all. Just the other, the remaining parietalis, remaining. Basalis, coronae villi is there. Capsularis, smooth chorion. Where this chorion is smooth, where there are no projections. This is the baby still growing here. You see it more. Then it develops more and more. Chorion. And then the amnion is here. That's your amnion chorion, and then I go through the placenta. Placenta proper is like eventually forms interaction, fetal part, maternal part, and then it forms the placenta. So it's usually like a disc in shape, not very, very 0.5 kg in weight and 3 cm thick. It has two surfaces, a maternal surface and a fetal surface. The maternal surface is rough, coming from the uterine endometrium. Right, they talk about it like appearing like cotyledons. They're marketed by fissures, right? So you see the fissures around it. And then the fetal surface is smooth. The fetal surface is smooth. You're going to attach the umbilical cord eventually, which is where the vessels will travel. And it has the amniotic membrane also spreads over it, right? The umbilical vessels will run in this, right? So you need to know the component. The maternal component is from the endometrium of the uterus, the decidua basalis, which he said is where the chorion has the villi, the projection. So that forms the maternal component. But the fetal component is your villous chorion. From the chorion that forms, is what forms the fetal component. So you call it the chorion frondosum. It's this interaction that eventually, you know I talked about the leg, the spiral arteries. It's this interaction eventually that now forms your placental circulation. And that is how the baby gets its nutrients and gas exchange and everything till it is delivered. So the next picture kind of explains it. You have spaces. There are different types of villi. The villi we talked about when the capillary shows. Some of them will anchor. Some of them will float. And then you have spaces in between the villi. So some of them will anchor. They will be fixed. But some are just free. They are floating there. So the intervillous spaces is the maternal blood from the uterine arteries, the spiral arteries in the endometrium of the uterus that fill those spaces. And then the tertiary villi will just float. And you talk about the exchange of gas, nutrients, and everything. So basically, your placenta, what are the functions? It helps with protection, nutrition, nourishment. You need nutrients for the developing fetus. And gas exchange too. And you also do excretion and hormone production, like we said. Once the placenta is well developed, then it takes over from your syncytial trophoblast. You know, it's like it forms from the syncytial trophoblast itself, but we don't call it syncytial again. It takes over from the syncytial trophoblast and becomes the endocrine organ. So it begins to secrete hormones. Hormones like your progesterone, human placenta lactogen, the human growth hormone. So the fetus keeps growing. So those are some of the hormones. This is like the placental circulation that is showing. The umbilical cord, fetal, right? The pressure, and the things you need to know is that they say the pressure in the maternal side is high, so that it forces it into the, like you want to push it into the fetal side to, for the fetus to get all those things that it needs. These are some of the villi. And the other thing you need to know is that we talk about the umbilical vessels, two arteries, one vein. The arteries is like it's reversed. Normal things that happen to us, the arteries are supposed to carry oxygen-rich blood. But in the umbilical circulation or the placenta circulation, the umbilical arteries carry oxygen-depleted blood, oxygen-poor. And then the vein is what carries the oxygen-rich. So, and then the flow, the direction of flow is also that way. So you want oxygen-rich blood, the vein will take it to, from the maternal side to the fetal side. And oxygen-poor, you take it back from the fetus to the mother, gas exchange occurs, and then you return it. So that's what does all those things. That's like the organ doing all those things, and the baby develops very well and is born. The next picture also shows it again. Fetal side, the umbilical vein, the arteries. And that's why, because the arteries carry oxygen-poor blood, that's why they are in color blue. And the vein carry oxygen-rich blood, that's why it's in color red. So it's going to go towards the fetus. These are the capillaries. So the fetal capillaries from the chorion to will interact with the maternal blood vessels. And this is all the interaction. This is from the base of the like the mother's uterine arteries and the vein. Eventually, spiral arteries, they have receptors for the hormones. Some of the hormones produce, and that's what keeps growing. And then they go and go, and you form that. The umbilical cord is just that. It's connective tissue, a kind of connective tissue that now surrounds the vessels with some fluid inside of it. There are different types. Some of them can be very short. They can rupture, and it can be very long. In some babies, they are so long that they can knot around. They can tie around the head. They can tie around the limbs. Right? So you can have cord accidents. Some babies are born with cord around the... And then it can also rupture. It can prolapse. Especially when the amniotic fluid is too much. It can start... Like the first part of the baby, you see maybe the umbilical cord. And it is very dangerous because that's what carries the blood from the mother to the fetus. At least until the baby is born and then it can do the independent this thing. So when it's an, there are emergencies when you see them in the hospital. You see umbilical cord protruding as the first part, then you need to be very, very worried, right? And then sometimes the number of vessels may be aberrant. It may just be one artery, one vein, or it may be two arteries, two veins. Those are abnormalities of the vessels in the umbilical cord itself. The other thing we need to talk about, we talk about the placenta and how it forms. We talk about the placenta abnormalities. So you have what we call accreta, increta, percreta, placenta previa. In accreta, it's just abnormal attachment of the placenta to what? So in the uterus, you know, there are different layers, the endometrium, the myometrium, and the perimetrium. So placenta accreta is attachment of the placenta to the what? To the myometrium, to the muscle layer. And then when we talk about percreta, percreta goes all the way to the perimetrium. You get it? These are questions they can ask you. Percreta, perimetrium. Accreta is just the next layer, the myometrium. And then increta is in between. You will see a picture. The next one shows you the picture. And then the other placenta abnormality that usually babies are born with is what we call the previa. Previa is just an abnormal insertion of the placenta in the lower uterine pole around the cervical opening, cervical horse. Normally, the placenta is supposed to be up here in the fundus, and then the cord goes down towards the baby. But in some women, the placenta is just down, low-lying across the cervical horse. In such women, we actually some of them are actually managed in the hospital throughout. So those are some of the placenta anomalies. Again, this is just showing you again, accreta, increta, percreta. So acreta is myometrium, increta is in between the two, and percreta is the perimetrium all the way up to the serosa. And then the previa, one can sit completely occluding it, and then you have another one just by the side, partial, so marginal. But the main one, this is like the classical placenta previa. You see the way it sits on it. In this kind of woman, you cannot do a digital vaginal examination. You cannot do anything. You just have to keep them in the hospital. When it is time to deliver, you decide on whether you want to do surgery or you want to do vaginal delivery. So those are some of the anomalies you need to know. The other thing is hemolytic disease of the newborn. So in hemolytic disease of the newborn, I just want you guys to know, how do we get it? How do you have a baby having what we call hemolytic disease of the newborn? For hemolytic disease of the newborn, you always have, always, a mother who is resource negative. You guys know what blood groups are, right? The resource D, the blood group D. So a woman who is D negative, resource D negative, and marries a man who is D positive, they are the ones that will have a baby that will have hemolytic disease of the newborn. You get it? So, and what happens? That barrier where there's no supposed to be exchange, as the placenta, as there's placenta circulation and you're exchanging it, the antibodies begin to what? To form, and then you have hemolysis of the fetal blood cell, and the child can have fetal anemia. So you can prevent it by giving anti-D antibodies, or you can do a fetal transfusion. This is what this is all about. We're almost done. Then we also have twin pregnancies. So sometimes some people have twin pregnancies. There are different types. Twin pregnancies can be dizygotic or monozygotic. For dizygotic, it's the most common type, and it usually results most times from fertilization of two oocytes, either by two spermatozoa. It's very common. So because there are two different oocytes by two sperms, you have two different amnions, two different chorions. Placenta may be fused or they may be separate. And most times, so dizygotic twins, they also call them fraternal twins or the false twins because it's two different oocytes. So because they are different, their genders may be different or they may be the same. The other type is what we call the monozygotic. In monozygotic, is one oocyte that is fertilized by one spermatozoa. But the thing is that at the blastocyst stage, when you have those division 2, 4, 8, 16, then they can split, there can be cleavage, and that single oocyte or that single embryo can now divide into two. So sometimes they are identical twins. You get it? And they are usually the same sex. So they may have two different amniotic sacs with one placenta and one chorionic sac. So they are different. So when we talk about dizygotic, usually different sex, they have two amnion, two chorion. But for monozygotic, they are usually the same. They are identical. They look very alike. You may not be able to tell them apart. They have two amniotic sacs, one amnion most times, and one placenta. They may be different types depending on the time the division happens, but that's the ideal thing you see. We take our next pause here. You guys will do your clicker questions here. Oops. Sorry, let me see. Is it open? Let me reset it quickly. Sorry. Okay, guys.